Good morning, Chief Justice, Justices. May it please the Court, Christopher Coist on behalf of Gerard Subielski. This was a case in which the defendant was driving a vehicle at a high rate of speed at different times through portions of Delaware. And at some moment, he entered into Route 1, and as testimony at trial outlined, he testified that the lights went out, some liquid hit him in the face, and then he saw some brake lights in front of him. He pressed on his brakes. He saw a truck. He veered in order to not strike that truck. And unbeknownst to him, he struck an individual and tragically injured him. At the trial, he was found guilty of assault first degree, and that made him a habitual offender with a life sentence. We've raised in our briefs arguments that there was improper comments made by the prosecution at various moments throughout the trial. And if I would put those improper comments in a few themes, one of those first would be, which was objected to by counsel, and I believe it was a rational objection, and that was a question was asked of Mr. Subielski by the prosecutor as to whether he spoke with his lawyer about some of the issues that he was having with the vehicle. Now, that was objected to for privilege. It was overruled. And our position is this is not only a violation of his privilege, his right to confidential communications with his attorney, but it also, especially once we look at the entirety of the record and how it proceeded into a closing argument, was a component of burden shifting by the state. This was an attorney-client privilege because if we step back and we think of what does opening yourself to cross-examination mean when you're a criminal defendant in a case? Does it mean that a prosecutor can now discuss with a criminal defendant all of his strategic conversations that he had with his counsel? Strategic conversations where, in the end, it's the counsel's determination as to whether an expert witness is retained.
What precisely was the question?
The question was whether he discussed with his lawyer the problems with the vehicle and did he try to get it checked out. And by trying to get it checked out, I advance, this is touching upon a potential need for expert testimony, someone to come in then and explain why the vehicle was malfunctioning in the way that Mr. Subielski claimed that it was malfunctioning. If we look at this from a little bit of a distance, if we open the door and allow questions like this to criminal defendants, especially when they are not the gatekeeper.
What was the trial judge's rationale for denying the objection?
There was not a stated rationale. It was overruled and it proceeded forward. But this question then provided what I would say is the foundation to where it became burden shifting. And it becomes burden shifting when a prosecutor who is allowed to make argument and to ask questions about the weakness of the defense's case, in closing arguments, makes a comment in which is indicating, although the defendant does not have any burden, they did not corroborate their testimony whatsoever. And I believe there were two absolutelys that were made in relation to that. That's what confuses, I would say, it is an improper argument. Because when you lay the foundation and lay arguments of what this person was supposed to have being done, meaning to have someone check out the car, and then you're buttressing that argument in closing by saying, did they corroborate their story? Well, there was actually a little bit of a partial corroboration. Mr. Subielski testified how he and his girlfriend, Ms. Martinez, went to McDonald's and got a Happy Meal that had a soda. And when the lights went out in the vehicle, Magdalena was yelling, the lights, threw the soda at him, and his right eye, the vision was impaired. The left eye was somewhat okay. This soda can was actually, or not soda can.
Well,
it was
your client testified, correct?
Correct, and he testified about that.
And once having taken the stand, would you agree that he's subject to you know, all of the usual impeachment techniques going to credibility.
Absolutely agreed, but I would say subject okay,
and if your client, as part of his direct testimony, laid out a story, his version of the events, he's subject to cross-examination on that, including questions as to whether he did anything to verify the facts that underlie his story. Would you agree with that?
I agree that a more rationalized questioning of him could have been done.
I don't know what that means.
What I mean, if he
says, you know, here's my story and it's based on fact X, is not the prosecutor entitled as a procedural matter to ask this witness or try to develop through the witness that he never checked out to see whether fact X was in fact true?
I think he's allowed to do that to a limited point, but here it touched upon privilege. And by touching upon privilege, that's where it went into the territory that it should not have gone into.
Well, he asked, didn't he, did you check out the car? And the answer was no.
Well, I was in jail.
And then the question is, well, did you ask your attorney to do that? And you're saying that crossed the line?
That clearly crossed the line, yes.
All right. But
it didn't cross the line because she wasn't entitled to cross-examine on that. Your point is it crossed the line because it invaded attorney-client privilege. Is that right?
It invaded attorney-client privilege, and then it became burden-shifting when a prosecutor is generically making arguments about need for corroboration.
Well, I think that's what Justice Jacobs is asking you about. If, by way of example, the question was, did you ask anyone to see what was wrong with your car? Would that have been a fair question?
An objection could have been rendered because it would touch upon potential privilege, because the anyone in this case, would, the most rational person, would be his counsel. But I can agree that if anyone would have been someone other than his counsel, that would have been a proper question.
Or if it said, have you asked anyone to check out your car? Or anything along those lines that doesn't specifically address a conversation with counsel, even though I understand anyone could theoretically encompass counsel. But the point, I think, is once he says as part of his defense, I didn't have the requisite mens rea to commit this offense. Actually, it was unavoidable accident because my lights failed me at a critical time, and then my girlfriend tried to help out by throwing a Coke in my face and blinded me in one eye. Then we had the accident. If it's blamed on mechanical failure of some kind, isn't the prosecutor allowed to address, have you determined the basis for the mechanical failure?
And I agree. I agree that questions could have been asked. There was an introductory question in relation to that. I believe that was proper, but the moment that it segued over to privilege is when it became improper.
But your point is that that question, or at least as phrased, invaded the attorney-client privilege. Is that the basis of your claim for error, or is the basis of your claim for error that particular question shifted the burden of proof?
I assert that is an improper question because it touches upon privilege, but then it becomes burden shifting when how it was used in the generic way by the prosecution.
Was it the combination of those two bad characteristics that underlies your reversible error argument, or just one of those two?
It's more than that. There were questions by the prosecutor that were demeaning, and then there was
Before you get to those, let's focus on this argument. Is it solely because the question invaded the attorney-client privilege, or is it solely because the question, however it was couched, shifted the burden impermissibly?
I would say it's both. And under the our argument is the totality of the improper comments is what calls for a new trial here.
Well, tell us about the other comments you believe were improper.
There was a reference made as my client was, he testified about the speed he was using on Route 1. And the prosecutor, it wasn't a question, it was just thrown out there about whether O.J. Simpson was there on the highway. That is a highly improper comment, because it wasn't even a question, to be throwing out at a trial.
Well, that's the question I asked you was, tell us why it's improper. Telling me it's improper doesn't tell me why it's improper.
The O.J. Simpson case resonates in people in our country, especially among people. I've heard it from many white people. O.J. Simpson was guilty of murder, and he got off. To mention the one case that everyone in our country would think of, it polarizes. African Americans, they may think it was just. Many white Americans do not believe it was proper. And to be throwing it into a case where a jury is going to be considering reasonable doubt and whether this person perhaps is guilty of a lesser offense under criminal negligence, there's no way I could even rationalize that it is a proper comment to be making at a trial. Then when you combine it with the other ways that a jury would be confused by allowing a defendant to be cross-examined in relation to his privilege, and then although a prosecutor is allowed to make final time, but I just will end that comment. Although a prosecutor...
Well, the specific comment is, he says, I said 30 as I was making the turn, and then she says, the prosecutor says, are you sure O.J. wasn't there on that route 40? What? I don't know what that means.
What it was referencing to is the white Bronco on the California highway that was proceeding at a slow pace. But what it would connotate to a juror who's sitting there in judgment over another individual, it mentions one of the most renowned cases in our country. There's no part in Delaware's criminal justice system where a comment such as that should be made. If I may reserve...
You want to save your time for rebuttal?
Yes.
All right.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. James Wakely on behalf of the State of Delaware. Yeah, what I was planning for this argument, I came to address the argument in the brief. And nowhere in the brief, on either the opening or reply, is there any argument that this invaded the province of attorney-client privilege. That may have been the objection at trial, but it was not raised anywhere in the brief. The reason the question came up as to whether Mr. Zubielski had done any level of investigation into this is because the first time this was mentioned at trial was during Mr. Zubielski's testimony. During the opening statement by defense counsel, there was no mention of accident. There was no mention of a malfunction with the vehicle. During all of the cross-examination of all of the state's witnesses, there was no mention of accident or malfunction of the vehicle, whether anyone observed it, heard it, anything. The first time it happened was during Mr. Zubielski's testimony. And it just so happened that the malfunction in the vehicle coincided with the officer's testimony that Mr. Zubielski turned off his lights as he drove into the construction zone. The state's theory being that Mr. Zubielski had tailored his testimony to the presentation of the state's evidence. And thus it became relevant when he put his credibility at issue, when he waived the privilege, and when he testified as to whether he had done it, whether there was
Wait a second. There's a difference between waiving the right to remain silent by testifying and waiving the attorney-client privilege. So you might have conflated the two, but when you say he waived the privilege by deciding to testify, what's the basis for saying he waived the attorney-client privilege?
Oh, certainly, Your Honor, he doesn't.
He just waived the right to remain silent.
He did. And when he put forward a theory of his case, the state was entitled to inquire as to whether there was anything on that theory.
Just to make sure I understand, Mr. Wakely, you're saying that the issue of whether or not the question itself invaded the attorney-client privilege is not before us because it wasn't raised in the briefs?
Yes, Your Honor.
So the only question is whether the question that was asked the defendant improperly shifted the burden?
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. None of the comments here by prosecutor, none of the questions, none of the comments by the prosecutor here were improper. Mr. Zubielski put his credibility at issue. He put forward a story. The state was entitled to question that and to comment on the fact that there was nothing to support it in closing.
All right. Well, just help us out. You know, we like to know the implications of our ruling. You said nothing was wrong here. I understand the issue of privilege might have been waived by not being raised in the briefs, even though it was raised at trial. But is it your position that it's proper to ask a defendant about conversations with their attorney?
It was probably a poorly phrased question. It could have been phrased more generically.
Well, let's see how I did with my question. Can a prosecutor ask a defendant about conversations with their attorney?
No. Had the prosecutor phrased it, did you ask anybody to look at the vehicle, that would have covered the same territory without necessarily implicating the right to privileged communication with counsel.
Evidently, the state's trial counsel disagrees with you because you not only asked the question, but you didn't help the trial judge out by saying, Your Honor, I think your ruling's incorrect, and I agree that question and answer should be stricken, and I'll approach it from a different perspective. Is that fair?
Yes, there was no comment from the prosecutor.
And can you enlighten us on why the trial judge overruled the objection?
No, Your Honor, there was no rationale given for why the objection was overruled.
The question, though, was did you ask your attorney to check out the condition of the car? Does that question, just because it was asked about a communication that went from client to attorney rather than attorney to client, would that question alone invade the privilege? As opposed to, what did your attorney tell you?
Well, I think the issue here is that there was more to it than just that question. The prosecutor started by asking, did you do anything? And his response was, no, I was incarcerated. And there is an understanding that when an individual is incarcerated, the communication to the outside will go through counsel. Did this invade, perhaps facially it invaded that privilege, but whether there was any, again, had he rephrased the question to just not include the phrase, did you tell your attorney, did you tell anybody, would have covered the exact same territory without being problematic.
All right, let's look at it differently. Take the attorney out of the equation. If the question was, and did you speak to the person who regularly services your car about any mechanical problems? And the answer was, I was in jail, I couldn't, whatever. Same answer, just the attorney's out of the equation. And the argument is that somehow shifted the burden of proof. As I understand, the state's position is, if you want to say there was a mechanical problem by way of nature of a defense, then you have to come up with some evidence in support of your defense. And it was totally proper for the state to ask, did you pursue independently coming up with any evidence to support your defense?
Well, Your Honor, the state's not suggesting that the defendant has to put forward any evidence. The state's only suggesting that we're entitled to question whether he attempted it first.
I understand that. So that's when you're saying that's okay.
Yes.
And we're not disagreeing. We're just trying to understand your argument.
Yes. The state would never suggest that a defendant has an affirmative burden to put forward anything. But again, as this was the first time anybody had heard this defense, it was, well, is there anything else coming about this? Do you have anything to back this up beyond just your statements that this occurred?
Okay, that's the question part. What about the comment in rebuttal summation?
It's simply commenting that there was no evidence that we had the testimony of Mr. Zubielski, and there was nothing else to back it up, and that it was directly contradicted by the testimony of the police officer.
If I understand the defense's argument or the appellant's argument on the rebuttal summation comment, it is a burden shift because it suggests to the jury that the defendant, if he was to be believed, should have introduced additional evidence.
The state would characterize that the argument quite differently. The prosecutor began by saying the defendant has no burden here. But he gave you a story, and it's directly contradicted by the vast bulk of the evidence that we've seen. And he hasn't given you anything else beyond a soda cup sitting in the car.
Well, the soda cup didn't go to the mechanical failure. The mechanical failure was, did the lights go out or were they turned off?
Well, part of the defense, as I understood it, was that he was temporarily blinded by his girlfriend throwing the cup in his face, the cup of soda in his face, and so he was blinded on one side and swerved, couldn't see, even without lights. The description at trial was this was fairly well lit up, even though this was 2:30 in the morning. There were massive construction lighting set up in the entire area.
All right, well, let's go back into the Chief Justice's question. Let's assume the defendant says there's a mechanical failure. I don't know what happened, but it was a mechanical failure. And the state says, well, did you pursue that? And the defendant said, no, I mean, it's just the mechanical failure. Is the state allowed to make an argument like the argument in this case that said, well, the defendant tells you it was a mechanical failure, but the defendant didn't present anything to support that statement?
Yes, I would say the state is permitted to argue the evidence that is presented at trial, that there was nothing presented that would support this theory by either side.
Well, if you read this rebuttal closing from a layperson's point of view, it sounds as if the prosecutor is making the statement that you're not entitled, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, to believe the defendant solely on his own word. He has to introduce additional evidence to corroborate himself, or he hasn't carried the burden of defending himself. A layperson could interpret it that way. And it says, the defense points you to a soda can, which is a misstatement of fact, in the car, and that somehow that corroborates the testimony of the defendant in this case. Well, what is corroboration? Even though it is true that the defendant has no burden whatsoever to present any evidence in the criminal case, when the defendant takes the stand, you may view his testimony just like you would view any witness's testimony. You may take into consideration whether or not that testimony is corroborated by other independent testimony. Did the defense, although having no obligation whatsoever to present a defense, bring anybody in here to corroborate that which the defendant said? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. Now, is that a suggestion that unless he brings in additional evidence other than his own word, he's not to be believed? And is that a correct statement of the law?
Twice during that particular excerpt, Your Honor, the prosecutor emphasizes the defendant has no obligation to present anything. But he did present a story. And it's certainly correct to point out there's nothing to support the story coming from either side, aside from the soda cup found in there. The prosecutor can argue the evidence that there was no evidence of this. The prosecutor can argue that the defendant gave a story and offered nothing to support that story. Once he got up there,
well, that's the point of the question. I'm trying to understand the distinction between the ability of the defendant to testify and then inconsistencies in the testimony being pointed out, or inconsistency between the defendant's testimony and others' testimony about the fact, as opposed to saying, in effect, to the jury, although the defendant has no burden, if you're to believe him, where's his cooperation? That's how that reads to me. Is that an unfair reading of it?
The state disagrees with Your Honor's reading of it. I understand your point, and clearly the argument that Your Honor would be making would be improper. To suggest that a defendant has any burden at all is improper. The question here was, did the prosecutor do that? And the state would suggest that he did not. But it doesn't even matter in this instance, because the evidence against Mr. Zubielski was overwhelming. He admitted that he was driving. He admitted that he was driving at a high rate of speed. He admitted that he was driving at a high rate of speed through a construction zone that he had seen earlier that same day and slammed into Mr. Carrillo.
Is this statement in the closing by the prosecutor accurate? Quote, the defense apparently is arguing to you that there was no substantial risk of death, so therefore find my client guilty of assault in the second degree. Close quote. Was that, in fact, what the defense was arguing?
That stemmed, Your Honor, from the fact that there was an instruction given for assault second, and the only way that the jury could flow to that is by making that particular finding. It was inarticulately put. Nowhere in defense closing did the defense argue that the jury should find him guilty of assault second.
Tell me why I shouldn't be troubled by a prosecutor mischaracterizing the defense argument to the jury when the prosecutor has the last word and defense counsel has no opportunity to correct it.
It was a correct statement of how the jury had to get to that point. The defense had requested an instruction on insult second.
They couldn't get there on the element of mens rea? Because that was the defense actual argument.
The defense of mens rea, the defendant was arguing that the charge went all the way down to vehicular assault second, not down to assault second.
I thought that the argument was he was negligent, not reckless.
Yes, and as the defendant put it, once you find that it was negligent rather than reckless, the jury had to convict of vehicular assault second, a misdemeanor as opposed to the felony charge.
Well, where does the substantial risk of death play in the defense argument at all?
It doesn't. As I said, Your Honor, it was inarticulately stated. It was perhaps improperly stated, but again, it flowed from the lesser included that were given.
And the defense didn't object when that statement was made, did they?
No. In fact, the only objection here, again, was to the invasion of the attorney-client privilege. That was the only objection made to any of these comments.
So even the burden-shifting arguments being reviewed for plain error?
Yes, sir. And that was conceded by Mr. Coist, except for, I believe, the comment about the did you check this out? He suggested that was available under this court's full review rather than plain error. If the court has no further questions, the state will rest on its brief.
Thank you. This case was a close case. It required an Allen charge. There was a lengthy deliberation. And in light of all of the errors that the court has taken note of, what we have outlined in our briefing, Mr. Subielski was convicted. I would say that the way the facts played out, the amount of time that it took to deliberate, and the fact that an Allen charge was needed, that would meet the closeness of the case element that would be needed.
Well, we just heard the Deputy Attorney General tell us that the evidence was overwhelming.
Then it was so overwhelming that a jury took days to deliberate and needed an Allen charge. I would disagree with that characterization that it's overwhelming, because the way the jury reacted to it is not how a jury would be reacting in a case that would be overwhelming. They would have returned a verdict within the same day or within hours, and it did not play out that way.
How do we deal with this plain error standard of review, which basically is saying, in essence, that something happened at trial that trial counsel didn't comment on, and yet it was so egregious that it compromised the fundamental fairness of the process, and there should be a new trial. And when we talk about the absence of an objection, we're always confronted with the dilemma, was defense counsel making a strategic decision, or did defense counsel just miss it? So how do we get where you want us to go with the plain error standard of review?
I don't think we need to be going the Rule 61 route, in which Mr. Haley would need to file an affidavit in relation to this. This case has already gone an amazingly strange route of we had to go through Rule 61 because of failures to file a notice of appeal, and Mr. Haley put in a mea culpa, allowing us to eventually prevail in order to be able to have our direct appeal. But I would note, I believe it's the combination of all of what we're outlining as errors, which is at page 24 of our opening brief, in which we describe each of the improper comments, the improper characterizations that were made in closing argument. I think when we analyze all those facts, it would have been incumbent upon the trial judge to sua sponte, step in there and make corrections, which was not done.
Why would not the trial judge have the reaction to this must be tactical maneuvering on the part of the defense? It's not so obviously egregious to me that I need to step in to avoid a mistrial. And if defense is not going to object to it, it must be part of their strategy or their tactics in handling the case. Trial judges are loath to jump in and second guess what defense counsel should be doing.
And my position would be that these errors are obvious. They should not be occurring. As Chief Justice noted in its line of questioning of the state, some of the way that the arguments were playing out were complete mischaracterizations of the defense's case. I don't think we could stand back and say it would be proper for a trial judge to allow a prosecutor to misstate the defense's arguments in contention. All that in closing, all that does is mislead the jury, which even in light of all the ways that a jury could have been misled here, they needed an Allen charge in order to end up with the end result, which was a conviction against Mr. Subias.
Were the instructions to the jury in this case given before or after the closing?
I believe that there were instructions given before and after. I don't have 100% recollection of that fact. The other thing I should note is, in closing arguments, when a prosecutor is making contentions about corroboration, that is a very dangerous gray area. It's especially a very dangerous gray area when a prosecutor is not very clear as far as what they are specifically arguing, as far as failing to articulate, especially when it's combined with misstatements of fact, such as a soda can, which was actually a soda cup, and there actually was a photograph. So at one moment we have a prosecutor who says, although the defense has no burden, he completely contradicts his statement by then making an argument that he has some sort of burden by implying that he needs to present evidence and hammering it home twice with the absolutely not. Are there any remaining questions?
No.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.